As I was saying at the outset, Venezuela, estimated 30 million people, an estimated 2 million have left the country, which is causing conflict in the region. And yes, let me repeat, the country is expected to reach inflation rates of 1,000,000% by the end of 2018, which has made food, medicine, other products in extremely short supply. People are hungry, people are desperate, and people are afraid. Now, how did this oil-rich nation, leading the economic charge in Latin America, fall into such disarray and spiralling out of control? We've visited Venezuela from time to time, but I really need to understand what the hell has happened and how it's happened. Apparently so quickly, President Maduro has announced some measures to try and rein in inflation. There's not much hope that they'll work. Joining us online to fill us in is Alejandro Velasco, who is an associate professor in Latin American history at New York University and executive editor of NACLA, that's N-A-C-L-A report, on the Americans. Welcome to our little program.
Thanks so much. I appreciate your invitation.
Can you give us a bit of background to how Venezuela got into the situation? Did it start with the death of Chavez, or was it before that?
Well, I think there are both nearer-term and longer-term explanations for the current crisis. Certainly, it's been tremendously exacerbated since Chavez's death, but to some extent, the foundations of the current crisis predate his death. So you mentioned at the outset that Venezuela is an oil-rich nation. There's a lot of confusion and as to how a nation that is rich in oil, not only broadly speaking, but in fact, it's got the world's largest proven oil reserve, something upwards of 500 billion barrels. Under its soil, how does it come to be in the situation? And to some extent, the explanation is in the question, precisely because it is this tremendously oil-rich nation. What has tended to happen historically in Venezuela is that governments of various stripes, whether they be democratic or socialist or authoritarian or dictatorial, tend to overspend what they have in times of plenty. And when oil prices collapse, then they are left basically holding the bag of enormous amounts of debt, as well as heightened expectations that were created in times of oil booms. And to some extent, that's basically what has happened in Venezuela. When Chavez was at his height, he spent lavishly, raising the economic indicators, as you mentioned. But when oil prices plummeted and Maduro was left holding the bag, we've begun to see some of these really horrifying turns.
How much impact have the U.S. sanctions had?
Well, it's interesting. The sanctions can be split into two. There are political sanctions and then there are economic sanctions. The political sanctions have had the kind of counterintuitive effect of actually deepening Maduro's hold on power by making it less and less likely that people within Maduro's entourage, his sort of closest advisors and supporters, will turn on him, since of course they are under a sanctions regime. And so, you know, that heightens the stakes for them to betray Maduro, and therefore it makes them more loyal to him. And so it's had that kind of an unfortunate political consequence. But the economic sanctions have had a significant effect insofar as they have curtailed Venezuela's ability to raise new cash. by basically barring Venezuela from selling bonds. Now, of course, you might ask, well, who would be interested in buying Venezuelan bonds, given just the depth of Venezuela's economic woes? But in part, people are not buying Venezuelan bonds because there are tremendous restrictions imposed on those bonds by the U.S. government. And so insofar as it's unable to raise cash through these conventional mechanisms, then that has meant that it has had to curtail tremendously any kind of spending that it would otherwise do on imports or foods and medicine. So in both of those respects, the sanctions have had somewhat counterproductive effects.
We haven't seen hyperinflation of this scale since Zimbabwe about a decade ago. Maduro has announced some measures to tackle it, but what can he possibly do?
That's a good question. What he can do are all the things that he won't do. What I mean by that is some of the measures that he's announced, for instance, raising the price of gasoline, which is the world's cheapest and highly, highly subsidized, and of course drains the coffers of the state significantly. But that also has a really terrible effect on the lives of everyday Venezuelans because everything goes up in price when the price of gasoline goes up. And so even though he's announced the rise in price of gasoline, he's also announced that there's going to be a differential rate for those who are supportive of the government and those who aren't, which will basically just breed corruption. Which is, at the end of the day, the underlying cause of Venezuela's misery currently. The fact that there is this galloping corruption that is promoted by and to some extent now sustains the government elite insofar as they have access to dollars, but then they trade those dollars and access to those dollars for political benefits among themselves and their acolytes. So the measures that he could take to try to stem some of the problems, for instance, lifting the differential exchange rate, creating transparency, moving away from sort of politicized expenditures. Those are the very things that are keeping him afloat and politically. And so as a result, he's unlikely to take those measures.
I know that you were last in Venezuela in January, but do you have a feeling of how things are for people at the moment with food shortages, medical shortages?
Well, food shortages and medicine shortages were already well underway in January. And at the time, the way that was mainly manifested was basically you had the emergence of a two-tiered economy. Those who had access to dollars, whether it be through remittances or because they had businesses outside of Venezuela, had some access to products because basically most of the economy has been virtually dollarized. And those without access to dollars, of course, they were left to fend for themselves either by going from store to store, making long lines for scarce products, or taking up as many jobs as possible just to raise a little bit more money. But then that would conflict with their ability to actually go find products when they were available. And then to that added the hyperinflation, which just meant that whatever you were able to earn today might not even afford you the products that you needed tomorrow. So that was very much already underway in January. Of course, what has happened since then that has dramatically affected social relations in Venezuela is, as you mentioned, this tremendous exodus, which began in earnest about 18 months ago, but even over the last 6 months has really just exploded. And what that means, of course, is that, households are losing, family members. That, of course, affects social relations within the family. The streets of Caracas are increasingly empty, even though, ironically, it continues to be hard to find scarce products. And ultimately, I think the major feeling is one not just of desperation, but of resignation that nothing is going to change the situation. And
now, the refugees are heading to Colombia, they're heading to Ecuador, Peru. Are they being welcomed?
They're being welcomed in some places and not in others. So Peru has proven far more welcoming of Venezuelan migrants than places like Brazil and Ecuador. In Brazil, we've seen actually some violent anti-Venezuela riots in the border state of Roraima. We've seen the governor of Roraima state in Brazil actually sue the government to allow it to close the border. In Ecuador, we've seen the government impose a series of restrictions on Venezuelan migrants that require passports. And of course, it's hard for Venezuelans to get passports in part because the government just isn't providing them. And so that effectively means that they can't enter. So they're finding it hard in Ecuador and in Brazil. Colombia has proven welcoming, but it's so drained of resources because it's where the bulk of Venezuelans have come that just makes it difficult, very difficult for the Venezuelans who do arrive to be able to fend for themselves once they get there. In other places, again, like Peru, Chile, even though they're further away and therefore attract a different kind of Venezuelan migrant, there have been policies in place that are proving more welcoming.
My guest is Alejandro Velasco, and we're discussing the crisis in Venezuela on LNL on RN, an attempt on Maduro's life earlier in the month by a drone. He claims it was Colombia or the far right in his own country. Any suspicions of your own?
Yeah, I think the reporting that we've seen since then has suggested really strongly that there's a faction sort of the opposition that is both domestic and abroad that spearheaded the charge to assassinate Maduro. What's significant about some of this reporting is that the plans for a day after are actually quite ambiguous. And so what that suggests is that there's a tremendous amount of factionalism among sectors of the opposition, again, domestic and abroad, that are just trying to find some advantage in a chaotic situation, right? So what the assassination attempt seems to suggest is that there is a cauldron of opposition sectors, some of them actually internal to the government itself, as certain sectors in the military try to find some sort of salvation in a transition regime. And that's creating some strange bedfellows. But in either case, what's not on the table is a plan for longer term stability. So right now, basically, what you find is that the sort of the fractured nature of the opposition is leading to, you know, these radical sectors to take matters into their own hands, regardless of what may be in the longer term interest of the country.
Usually, at a point like this, one talks about military coups, but you don't think that's likely?
It's not likely, but it's certainly possible. That's one of the challenges of thinking about Venezuela. Much like its currency, it changes day to day. Certainly at present, especially given how many high-level military officials are under sanctions regime by the United States, the European Union, Canada, and others, the incentives are low for them to align themselves with any kind of coup plotting. On the other hand, they might say, especially if they position themselves as sort of saviors of Venezuela, that they are the only potential resource available to the country to be able to stabilize. The problem is that the military in Venezuela, among Venezuelans, especially those actually that support the government, is so completely discredited precisely because they are completely enmeshed in the corruption, sort of food scheme, food selling schemes, medicine selling schemes, etc., that they are no guarantee for any kind of stability afterwards. Of course, they do have weapons, and that's something. But in terms of political stability that would result from the kind of credible coalition among competing sectors of power in Venezuela, the military is not the guarantee of that.
Thank you very much for your time. I've been talking to Alejandro Velasco, Associate Professor in Latin American History at the New York University, and he's the author of Barrio Rising, Urban Popular Politics and the Making of Modern Venezuela, published by the University of California Press. And now we're going to look at the dreadful mess Australia's religious institutions are in, and can they get themselves out of it. Hallie Nell on RN.